He offers forgiveness and a fresh renewal of the covenant. Israel's faithfulness will be restored, and they will call God their husband, no longer chasing after false idols. And this renewal, of course, reflects God's love, his unwavering love. And it's symbolized on the ground by Hosea's reconciliation with his unfaithful wife. All right, folks, well, you know this, but Thy Strong Word is supported by the Lutheran Heritage Foundation. Now, you know what? I don't throw these promos out because I have to for some reason. I am not only very grateful to LHF for their underwriting of the program, but I generally love the ministry that they do. For no cost at all, they will help you get Christian publications like the Small Catechism, Bible storybooks for children, or one of 100 other resources, hundreds of other resources. They're going to get those to you in the languages of the people that you're serving. That's amazing. So if you want to learn more about what they do, visit them online at lhfmissions.com. And if something in today's discussion sparks a question or a thought in your mind, you know I want to hear from you, reach out to me by email. That's the best way to reach out to me during the show, thystrongword@kfuo.org. And more casually, you can find me if you want to keep the conversation going. You can find me on X at Pastor Boo or on Facebook. I'm still there as Phil Boo. All right, my guest for this morning, he comes on the show every now and then. It's the Reverend John Lukumsky. Here every month, he's the co-host of Wrestling with the Basics on KFUO on the weekends. But brother, welcome back. I'm always happy to have you on.
Yeah, glad to be talking to you again, a fellow Minnesotan up here in God's country with beautiful weather. So yeah, yeah.
It is amazing right now. You cannot get better weather. Problem is, though, school has started back up. And, the last 2 days, I don't know. I've just been wrestling with my kids here to get them to go to school. I don't know. They're both smart. They don't like it. I don't know. I guess I didn't like school when I was a kid either. It's tough.
Yeah, that's what my daughter actually was complaining about, her daughter not wanting to go to school. And she said, you know, I always liked school. And I said, but, well, you know, sweetheart, you were weird. you need to realize that, yeah, most kids don't. They don't like to go to school. But, that's the problem. Isn't that so sad? The weather's beautiful, and now they're stuck in school. But
I know.
Me.
That's what made me think of it. I would be like them. I'd be like, I don't want to go to school either, but here I am. I'm right. Sitting inside. But you know what? Sometimes you have to do things that you don't like because they're important. And you know what? Sometimes that even applies to reading the Bible. Some people say, well, you know, I just find reading the Bible to be just so difficult and it's hard to understand. Well, there's lots of tips that can help you. But even if you struggle a little bit, being in the Word is something that is always going to pay off, even if you kind of have to bite your lips a little bit. And that's what we're going to do today. We're talking about Hosea. It has been one negative, judgmental thing after the other from a place of God's jealousy, his righteousness, but he doesn't leave them in despair. So I think we actually get a nice gospel text today.
Oh yeah, you gave me the better text. I don't know who you had on the first chapter, but like you said, that was just one judgment after the other. And what's cool about this text is there's no transition. It's like boom, all of a sudden it's all changed. It's all different right from the get go. Although here's my question to you. Mm-hmm. So my wife and we're doing Isaiah in our morning devotions. And a lot of the same stuff in Isaiah, you know, you get judgment, and then all of a sudden, here's God promising his forgiveness and his restoration. But what had occurred to me is in Isaiah, that actually happens, because, of course, he's talking to the people there in the southern kingdom in Judah, and they're going to be, you know, surrounded by the Assyrians, they're going to be besieged, and yet God will prevail. In fact, God will send his angels and literally kill hundreds of thousands of Assyrians. The people in Judah, Jerusalem won't even raise a finger, and God will deliver them. But it dawned on me, God's making all these promises. This is to the northern kingdom that Hosea is speaking. This is to Israel. Mm-hmm. And it won't happen. They're going to get overrun by the Assyrians, and their kingdom will never, ever be established again. There will never, ever be a northern kingdom, the kingdom of Israel. I hope our listeners understand, because it does get confusing. We refer to Israel and we think about the entirety of the Jewish nation. But in this particular instance, no, this is the Israel of the north. This is the kingdom that has split into as a result of a civil war. And the people that God is addressing here as a nation, they won't come back. They won't be restored like Judah will be. So you almost have to think that Hosea is not really specifically speaking about those people, but he's speaking about what's going to happen in the future, and speaking about us, I suppose, that these are the things God's going to do for us. Anyway, I don't know. What do you think about that? How did you deal with that?
Well, I'm glad you brought it up, because I think it is an important thing to get under our belt. And, I agree with your assessment. I would even nuance it a little further, and that is to say that, all right, so we look at the way that he's proclaiming this judgment, but also interdispersing within the judgment that there is going to be coming a restoration. And you rightly say that, hey, listen, they don't actually get restored. I'm going through on Sunday with my folks. I'm calling it out of context, and we're just grabbing all of those out of context Bible verses that people love to use, like, for instance, Jeremiah, 29:11, I think, where God says, I know the plans I have for you, plans to give you peace and hope and a future. That's a little bit of a paraphrase.
Yeah.
So he says that to people in Jeremiah. And then he's speaking, of course, about the future when he will restore them, to give them a future, to give them a hope. And I tell the folks, you know, listen, these look great on T-shirts and mugs and inspirational calendars, but unless you are the exiled Israelites in Babylon, that verse really doesn't have anything directly to do with you. But at the same time, it doesn't really have anything directly to do with the people he's saying it to either. Because when he says this to them, I know the future I have for you, it's a message of hope, a message that of prosperity. He's saying it to people who he's also told that they basically will die in exile, because he will visit them in 70 years. So most of the people hearing the message of hope and a future and plans are people for whom they will never see the fruit of those plans. So when we take that verse out of context and say, oh, yeah, God has a plan for me and he's got my whole life mapped out so I don't have to worry, that's a misuse of that text. But in the same way, the people he's speaking to, I don't think they think of it as individuals. I think that they think of it far more as a people. You know, they're overjoyed, not necessarily because they themselves will escape exile, but the people of God will escape exile. So heading back to what you were saying, yes, Hosea's up there proclaiming to Israelites that they need to repent, that basically the time has come, that they will be no more. But all of the talk of hope isn't for them as an individual nation, or certainly not as individual people, but as the people of God. So when God says, I'm going to give you hope in Jeremiah, but even here when he talks about there being this future restoration, absolutely, that restoration comes partially when he actually releases them from exile, but it becomes in its fullest, most ultimate form when Jesus comes. And now the people of Israel, not the nation that was in division against Judah, certainly not the modern nation state of Israel, but Israel as in the people of God have indeed been restored, released not from exile to the Babylonians, but from bondage to sin. And so, yes, the long way of saying I agree with you.
So I really like the point you made there about those words of Jeremiah to the people who won't ever see that fulfilled. Because like you said, they'll die. They'll die in Babylon. Even as the people that Hosea is addressing, they won't see this restoration. Rather, they will see Assyria come in and just wipe them out. That'll be the end of it. But what I like about that is because this is how we experience life. I too get concerned about the people say, oh, you know, just have enough faith and everything will work out just the way you want it. And I'm thinking, I don't know what world you live in, But the world I live in, ultimately, no, things don't work out the way I want them. I've already lost one wife, okay? And now that we're both in our 70s, I realize, yeah, this is not going to end happily. I hope it doesn't happen soon. I hope we have another 20 years. But you know, no, in the end, we're going to die. That's what's going to happen. But mm-hmm. see, to me, that's what I love these promises, because it's the reminder that that's not the end of stuff. You know, if we weren't a Christian, sure. Well, then I don't know. It's just hopeless. But as Christians, we understand, oh, yeah, there is another kingdom prepared for us. There is a restoration. And it'll be so wonderful and so great. It'll make what we thought was good and blessed here, we'll realize, oh, that really wasn't anything at all. So I really appreciate that business that you said about Jeremiah, because I'm thinking that's pretty much the situation it is. Here and now, we probably won't see but that doesn't mean we won't see it. It just means it's not going to be here in this sinful world. And so then don't get frustrated with the problems and the trials and getting old. That's just what happens. But all the promises God has made still remain true.
Yeah, and your illustration of that is right on point, right? So if we had our way, we wouldn't die, right? No. I mean, if I had my way, Jesus would come back before the end of the show. And I love being here and I love being on the show, but, you know, I think all Christians are just ready. But at the same time, things don't happen the way we want if we have enough faith, but things will always happen the way God wants. So does God have all of our lives planned out? I actually do not believe that's the case. At the same time, he does have our future planned out. And the future is that we will be with him. So yeah, you want to be with the Lord. I want to be with the Lord, but neither one of us want to die. But that might be what happens before we get to see that fulfillment. Again, unless the Lord returns. So same thing here. Yeah, you're right. We're talking. He's talking to folks who, many of them have literally turned their hearts against the Lord. So they're not even really thinking like, that's not fair. They really have just rejected God. But the future is that God is going to be just fine. In fact, his people are going to be just fine. And it's the same with the church. I was sharing with the elders last night, or maybe it was my Bible study. No, it was my Bible study. But anyway, I was talking with folks, and I said, I got a little trouble at my first congregation. I was fresh out of sim, and I was preaching a sermon. And I just said in passing that that our congregation is not promised to last forever. We were 140 years old, but still. And very healthy, but still. And I said, the LCMS is not promised to last forever. But at the same time, God's church will last forever. It does take a few different forms over the world as people strive to be faithful. I think we're in that group right now. But God's not worried about the success of his church. And that's what he's saying to these people. He's not concerned with the success of his people. He's going to provide for them. The question really on the table is, do you want to be there when he redeems you? And I don't mean necessarily when he redeems them from slavery, but that is when you meet him face to face, is he going to recognize you as one of his own? And that's what I think Hosea is laying down.
So what you just said touches me personally, because as a retired guy, I don't have a church anymore, but they call you in to come and preach at various places. And so there's two churches here up in Minnesota. You may even be aware of them, Owatonna and Redeemer Owatonna. And then there's a little church in Kilkenny. I don't know how we got a bunch of Irish people in the middle of Minnesota, but yeah. And I've had the sad news this last month of finding out that I won't be preaching at those two churches next summer because they're both closing. One will probably close the 1st of January, and the other will be closed sometime within the next year. But it's just what you said. I when I get to my final chance to preach to them, I need to remind them, okay, well, yeah, your building here, your history is coming to an end. And that's really sad because people love their churches. And I know the people are sad there already. I can see that. But the thing is, like you said, no, the kingdom is not over with. The kingdom will continue. You go someplace else, the same Lord Jesus, the same supper, the same word of forgiveness, the angels and archangels and all the hosts of heaven, they'll still be there. You know, that's the thing we need to remember. Like you said, God's going to do what he wants to do, and it's good. It'll be good, you know. So, yeah.
You know what it kind of reminds me of a little bit? And you're right. By the way, I got in trouble because the elders came into my office and were like, you can't say that kind of stuff. And, you know, they had just, they kind of thought I was just trashing the congregation. And I understand that. I don't hold it against them. But no, that's not what I was saying. What I was saying is just what you're saying. It is devastating when a congregation closes, just as it's devastating when we lose a spouse or we ourselves face the end. But it's kind of like when a king dies. What do they say? The king is dead. Long live the king. Because the kingdom will continue regardless of who's in charge. Our king died and rose again. So how much more will his kingdom persist forever? Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't we go ahead and add some verses to our conversation? We actually haven't even said one. I've been having such a good time talking.
Make one real quick comment because I really appreciate what you said there too about it being devastating. See that's the other side. We don't want to give people the impression that it's not hard. Of course it's hard, and we cannot perceive it except for being hard because we are sinful people in a sinful world. However, what we are now going to share with people is the truth that God has given us. Okay, so sure, be sad, struggle with that, but don't ever forget what Jesus said is actually going to happen. And that's what we're going to see described now in these verses.
I'm actually glad that you reiterated that because it is so important. I hope I never endure seeing a congregation close while I'm there. And I certainly hope I don't have to endure the loss of a spouse for sure, especially children. But, you know, that's why even in the face of all these things that we mourn in this life, we do, just as you said, we keep an eye on Jesus. Now, just to kind of give you that stark change that occurs, I'm going to head back to verse 12, and then we'll move our way into our new texts, just so you can kind of hear the shift that Pastor Lukumsky was talking about. Verse 12, I will lay waste her vines and her fig trees, of which she said, these are my wages, which my lovers have given me. I will make them a forest, and the beasts of the field shall devour them. And I will punish her for the feast days of the Baals, when she burned offerings to them and adorned herself with her ring and jewelry and went after her lovers and forgot me, declares Yahweh. Therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. And there I will give her her vineyards and make the valley of Achor a door of hope. And there she shall answer as in the days of her youth, as at the time when she came out of the land of Egypt. And in that day, declares Yahweh, you will call me my husband, and no longer will you call me my Baal. For I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth, and they shall be remembered by name no more. All right, I'm just going to pause there. It keeps going, but yeah, what a when he says, therefore, behold, you really think that the next words are, I'm going to completely wipe them off the face of the earth. But he doesn't. He basically says, I don't want to interpret it just so I'm going to leave that to you. But it seems like he's saying, hey, I'm going to show you why you should be faithful. I don't know. So tell us about the shift. Why is it so stark, you think?
Well, it is. It's just like night and day. Of course, one of the commentators I read suggested that's kind of the sense of behold. Like you said, I've told you all this terrible judgment, but now look at this. You won't believe this, okay? This comes out of nowhere. And there's a relationship, though, that this word therefore, it's almost like because of God's terrible judgment. Like that almost has to precede what's going on here in this great restoration. And I wonder if there isn't some truth to that. Man, we had that passage from a couple of weeks ago in Mark where God says, you know, here's your problem. Here's what comes out of the heart. And I don't know if I can remember all that stuff, but what was it? Theft and adultery and sexual immorality and envy. And I mean, he lists all these terrible things that are true of every single human heart, comes out of the inside of us. And yet, until we know that, we can't really appreciate what God has done for us in terms of the restoration and the forgiveness and the mercy. I mean, we almost have to have that wrath and anger of God before you can truly understand the beautiful things that he's saying here in this text. Because if you don't understand that, then I guess you kind of think God's just doing what what he owes you. You know, what's your due? Because you've been such a good person. So I just, that tickled me that, you know, maybe we really do need to have those terrible, harsh words of judgment and come to the realization that's what we deserve, to really appreciate all this wonderful tenderness and everything that he's doing in this text.
That's a fascinating point. So you talk about the necessity sometimes, or maybe always, of this judgment coming before the mercy. Well, first of all, the mercy is from his judgment. That's kind of the critic. Yes. That's the critical view that even atheists will give. And they'll say, well, God's basically saying that you either need to believe in me and follow me, or I'll punish you. But if you do, you'll be saved from my punishment. And the funny thing is, they think that's some sort of gotcha, like, oh, look how circular the argument is. But at the end of the day, if God is who we believe him to be, and of course he is, that is the creator of the universe, then yeah, he actually has the right to say that. And we always think of God, because he's been so domesticated over the years, and that's Christianity's fault a little bit, but that we think, well, he's just sort of our buddy. And while God is understanding, we certainly know that God is wholly other. And I'm using the word W-H-O-L-L-Y, completely other. So there was a pastor named Shadrach Meshach Lockridge. I mean, first of all, that's an amazing name for a pastor.
That's a great name.
He was the pastor of Calvary Baptist Church in San Diego, California. He died in 1993. But here's the deal. So he died in 2000. But I got a quote from him once, and while you were talking, I looked it up again. So he once preached on creation and the nature of God, and this is what he said. Here's the quick quote. He said, "The reason God came from nowhere was there was nowhere for him to come from. And coming from nowhere, he stood on nothing, for there was nowhere for him to stand. And standing on nothing, he reached out where there was nowhere to reach and caught something where there was nothing to catch and hung something on nothing and told it to stay there." Now, first of all, it's beautiful. But secondly, I combine that with Martin Luther, who said, "It is God's nature to make something out of nothing. Hence, one who is not yet nothing, out of him, God cannot make anything." And so I think both Pastor Lockridge and Dr. Luther are in their own ways saying what we're saying and saying what you're saying. And that is that God doesn't take us and kind of put a coat of paint on us and refurbish us up, put some Bondo on the dents and try to sell us off as new. He strips us down to nothing and rebuilds us in his image. And if we were then to go astray, he has to start over again. And that's what he's doing with his people. And he does that with us daily, every time we are reminded of our baptisms and need the forgiveness.
You know, it's interesting because that's Paul's image. Paul always talks about us in Christ being a new creation. And of course, that's the problem. People don't want to be a new creation. They just want to have some improvements, a little remodeling done. But of course, no, trust me, it's rotten down to the wood, you know, that we have to scrap it and start from scratch, which of course is what happens with Jesus Christ. And I'm thinking, as I look over these verses, it occurs to me that's kind of what's happening here, because we start with this image of a wilderness, and yet in the wilderness, he's going to have these vineyards. Well, how does that happen? Wildernesses don't have vineyards. But there again, there's that God you're talking about who starts with nothing and brings everything about. Luther commented on those verses and said, see, that's to remind us it has to be of faith. You can't... There's no logic reason to assume that something like this would happen, that a God of wrath and anger who justly condemns you will instead allure you and speak tenderly. No, that just has to be believed, which of course is where we're at every day of our lives. There are so many religions out there that want to prove, but no, you cannot prove the love of God. Oh, I mean, there's plenty of proofs. I look around right now in Minnesota, and we have all kinds of greenness and beautiful weather, and it's just, but I also know I'm leaving here because Pastor Boo, in just a few months, it's going to be cold and nasty. That's what it's going to be. So does that mean God doesn't love Minnesota anymore? I'm going south, back to St. Louis.
Oh, well, come on. That's not South. I mean, hey, I love St. Louis, right? We're in St. Louis now, but I yeah. Come on.
No, I know. If I didn't
I go to
family,
Arizona,
I
Florida, Texas, you
Arizona.
Know.
Arizona. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I actually love St. Louis. Go ahead.
So I didn't realize this until right before the show started. Okay. But apparently he says, therefore, behold, I will allure her. And it turns out that the word allure actually is usually a negative word. It's the word for when someone's enticed to things they shouldn't be enticed to. It's usually associated with people that are foolish and therefore they're susceptible to being scammed. Why do you think that God chose that word to describe what he... Now the next business about speak tenderly to her, which literally means to speak from the heart. Yeah, that I really appreciate. But I wonder why the Holy Spirit chose to use that word, allure her.
I do have some thoughts. I mean, I'm just thinking them now. I didn't catch that when I was reading it.
I didn't either. I didn't either.
The Hebrew is related to the idea of being simple, like simple-minded. Yep. So you're right. Yep. There's a negative connotation to this idea that one who can be deceived. And so here's why I think. So if that's the case, if this is a word used often to talk about those who are simple-minded and easily led astray, I think he's using it as a hinge for the reality that you've been led astray in this direction. Now I'm going to lead you not astray, but I'm going to now basically use against you what caused you to go astray to draw you back to me. Which makes me a little nervous because I would hate to think that this would empower churches to use sort of attractional models to get people into the doors. I don't know. Maybe you're on board with that. But there is something to this idea that like God, and we say this as Christians too, God's will for us, our faith, even the duties and responsibilities of our faith that might sometimes be hard, those things aren't bad things. It's wonderful. And they're actually... Even amidst the difficulties of living out of faith in this world, there are so many beautiful, wonderful things. So if one is easily allured, as they seem to have been, to the Baals, I think that's maybe why he's saying, I'm going to allure you back. Maybe that's the use of the language. But gosh, I don't know. That's just off my cuff. What do you think?
Well, that's actually the same thought I had, that it does reflect, like you said, that you're dealing with simple people. And now, and I really like the way you said that. So, yeah, you were simple people and you got sucked in by the Baals, which, of course, is beyond simplicity. It's just stupid. Didn't it ever dawn on you that they weren't doing anything for you after that long history of everything that God has done for you? A reference here back in the wilderness, how he freed you from Egypt and all that. It is interesting that the word that is used here for simplicity, it's not the same word, though, for foolish. It's almost like the Bible makes a difference between the fool, who I suggest someone who actually should know what's right and wrong, and yet he refuses to do what he knows is right and wrong. Okay, so he knows better, and yet he doesn't act on what he knows, whereas is this word... It's more like Paul. You know, Paul said, you know, God gave me mercy because I didn't really know what I was doing. Or Jesus prays, Father, forgive them for they do not know. I think that's more the sense here. These people, they really were dumb. They really did think there were Baals, you know. But now God's going to show them what it really should be. And they're open to that. I don't know. It was just strange. It certainly is a beautiful picture we have here where God says, I want to address you as my wife. I want to treat you that way. And so, yeah, allure, speak tenderly, give her gifts, vineyards and all that stuff. And isn't it also impressive that he literally is going to take care of the idolatry.
Mm-hmm.
See, we usually think of idolatry as something that we need to do, but God says, no, I'm gonna remove the names of Baal. When I'm done with you, you won't be worshiping any other false gods. Why? Because you're so good and you've made the... No, you're simpletons. You can't make that choice. But I'm gonna see that that's what happens. Yeah.
Yep. So I think, yeah, he's luring them back. Well, I tell you what, you know what's alluring me right now is the clock and the board operators. They're like, hey, we need to go to break. So that's what we're going to do, folks. We'll head to break when we come back. Pastor Lukomsky and I will be right back into this topic in Hosea chapter 2. We'll see you on the other side.
These are the voices of young Lutherans in Mexico City, children who are excited to learn more about their Savior, Jesus. But they need our help, because good Lutheran books for kids in the Spanish language are in short supply in Mexico. To learn how you can help tell Spanish-speaking kids everywhere about Jesus in a language they can understand, go to the Lutheran Heritage Foundation website at lhfmissions.org/Juan316.
Welcome back to Thy Strong Word. I'm your host, Pastor Phil Boo. With me today, it's the Reverend John Lukomsky, co-host of Wrestling with the Basics, also here on KFUO. Hey, by the way, folks at home, if you haven't gotten your September issue or haven't had a chance to read through it of The Lutheran Witness, be sure to do that. It's a whole episode, a whole edition, I suppose, a whole, what do you call these? Well, anyway, it's a whole magazine basically celebrating the 100th anniversary of KFUO Radio. It's got a ton of amazing stories and the history behind the station, and it contemplates the future. And I think you're in there, aren't you? Pastor Lukomsky? You're mentioned in there.
Well, this is what I've been told. I don't get the Lutheran Witness, but yeah, I've been getting these emails from people that say, "Oh, I see." So I guess I am.
Yeah. You're famous.
I didn't get paid
aside
any
from
money
being a famous
for it.
KFUO host. Well, it's actually a great magazine, a bunch of stuff that, I mean, when I came on board with KFUO, even before really, but especially when I came on board, I did all my research about the history and stuff. It's just fascinating. And this edition does a great job. Hey, folks at home, though, again, if you want to jump into our discussion, though, anything catching your interest or raises a question, a correction, compliment, a comment, question, whatever you want to send, that's fine. Send it to me at thystrongword@kfuo.org. Okay, well, here we go. Let's head back into the text. So yeah, he says, I'm going to remove the names of those false gods. You're not even going to remember them anymore. Picking up with verse 18. And I will make for them a covenant on that day with the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, and the creeping things of the ground. I will abolish the bow, the sword, and war from the land, and I will make you lie down in safety. I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice, in steadfast love and in mercy. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know Yahweh. And in that day I will answer, declares Yahweh. I will answer the heavens, and they shall answer the earth, and the earth shall answer the grain, the wine, and the oil, and they shall answer Jezreel, and I will sow her for myself in the land, and I will have mercy on no mercy. And you are my people, and he shall say, you are my God. All right, so that's the end of the chapter, actually, verse 23. We're going to head into chapter 3 here in a minute. But so he's going to make this covenant. I want to talk about that. But also, this, if we're talking about when this stuff is fulfilled, we can tell right away, I think, brother, that some of it has not yet been, right? I will abolish the bow, the sword, the war from the land. That is absolutely not the case yet. So there is some future fulfillment yet to come.
Right. And we see this, the same thing in Isaiah and the other prophets. And definitely we're talking about something that, like you said, that even you and I haven't experienced yet, although it's begun. it's begun. Everything he's talking about here began when Jesus Christ was born as a little babe in the manger, moved forward as he ministered and healed and preached the word, and of course, in his suffering and death and resurrection and his ascension. But it's still more to come, because like you said, we don't have peace now. The animals and we aren't getting along. The mosquitoes still bite us up here in Minnesota. But that's so nice to know. This is what's ahead. This is what's coming, especially since he began by saying he was going to take us out in the wilderness. So I think we need to remember that at this point, we're in the wilderness, okay? Yeah. But again, we know what happens at the end of the wilderness. You get to the promised land. That's been the picture. That's the pattern all along. And we have, and you know what's really, and we don't have the time to do this, but you know this because you did the first chapters and everything. Essentially, each one of these verses is a reversal of what you heard in the first chapter, isn't it? Everyone, there was a curse, there was a judgment, and now every one of these things is being turned over.
Yeah, it's very powerful. You know, we wonder, like, why this whole making Hosea name his children Jezreel and, you know, no mercy and not my people. And it's for this. You know, it's that same language of tearing down to rebuild. And so I will have mercy on no mercy and say to not my people, you are my people. And he shall say, you are my God. So, you know, we have the parallel with Gomer and Hosea and his children. But of course, the subject is the people of God. And the people of God are more broad than the people that are on the ground who receive this message contemporaneously in real time. With that said, too, you know, a lot of folks say, well, this restoration, right? And then this beating the plowshares kind of language that we also get from Isaiah. That's, yeah, sure, that's heaven. But, you know, that's supposed to take place in the land of Israel right now. And the problem with that is that is not the promised land. It was part of the land promised to the people. But that even that promised land was pointing forward to the greater promised land. And so I just say that for those who might be a little maybe confused or possibly even misled, that somehow the temple has to be rebuilt or the place around where we call Israel today has to somehow come back into use for God. It'd be wonderful, but that's not the case.
Well, see, that's the thing. That was all because God comes down to earth. I mean, that's the remarkable thing we've got to start off with. If I were God, I'd just sit up in the heavens and I'd throw a few lightning bolts down, some thunder.
Right.
Maybe every once in a while rain some manna or whatever. But I wouldn't want to get down and dirty, you know. But see, that's the thing. The whole plan was that God would actually come here on earth. From the very beginning, that was the design. And that means he has to involve human people, human nations. And he did that. He had a nation of Israel, and he miraculously preserved them. They should have been wiped out ages ago, but he miraculously preserved them because he had to have this child of his, this son of his, born in Bethlehem. That's what he promised. He always keeps his word. He never lies. He had to suffer and die there in Jerusalem again because that's what the prophets had said was going to happen. But see, once that was done, then there's nothing special about Jerusalem anymore. And in fact, Jesus says, you know, this is all going to get destroyed because its purpose has been accomplished. So no, you're right. We don't need a temple again because Jesus is the temple. That's what he says. I am the temple. I am where God dwells. So I agree with you. It's unfortunate that people think that somehow there has to be these physical manifestations. But the fact of the matter is, everything that needs to be done has been done. We're just waiting for Jesus Christ to come back, and all of this described here will be fulfilled. So I don't know what else to say. You're just wasting your time if you think that somehow has to be an earthly Israel. In fact, see, well, we'll get to that promise where he says you're going to have the king. They're going to come back to King David, but. There is no King David anymore. It's not like King David is going to be resurrected from the dead, but he's talking about the one who is King of Kings, who does call an earthly king his ancestor, David, but that's Jesus Christ. So, yeah.
Yeah, there's a reason why when folks, while Jesus was walking the earth, that it was significant that, say, people would call him the Son of David. That isn't just sort of a nice phrase that'd be kind of polite to say. That was a recognition of just what you said. And likewise, you know, we have here, and we've wrestled with it already, that Gomer and Hosea are kind of living this out in real life. But we all live this out. Back in, or forward, really, in Ephesians 5, you know, Paul says, wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. And then he says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. And we have all the wonderful teaching that comes from those properly understood. But then 29 of Ephesians 5, he says, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it just as the Lord does the church. So the Lord cherishes the church. The church is his people. That's what we see. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. And then he quotes, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And we're thinking, okay, that's great. And then he says that famous passage that throws everything on its head. This is a great mystery. I speak concerning Christ and the church. So back to this marriage talk, I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you to me in righteousness and justice and steadfast love. God is married to his people, and he's our groom, our husband. We are his wife. That's the language he's been using, but he's doing all the work. Let's be honest, you know, he's doing all the work, but he's keeping us faithful too. And so that's why we see this, even in a marriage, as you know, Pastor, having not only been married, but counsel others in their marriage, it's sometimes extremely, extremely hard and painful. And if you haven't experienced that, that's wonderful. But if you do, just hang in there. And that's what's going on here. There is a lot of pain in the marriage, but God's eternal faithfulness is what he's using to allure them back to him.
So one of the points, I read Luther's writings on this, and one of the things that he said that struck me is he says, I'm going to make a covenant on that day. By the way, that phrase, anytime in the Bible you see on that day or in that day, that's all messianic talk, right? That's stuff that's yet to come. We're waiting for that day to show up. But anyway, he said, not only does he make a covenant, which of course he did that with the fathers. He did that with Abraham, with all those that came before. But now it even gets better, because now it's not just a covenant, but it is, as you said, it is this marriage, that is this betrothal. A covenant is an agreement we make, and we could get into the discussion about the different kinds of covenants and the fact that this is a covenant where the one who is powerful, the one who is strong, simply says, I'm going to do these things for you. But there's a kind of connection and emotion and an attachment that you hear in the word betrothed. I think we can all remember back to when we fell in love and we said, will you marry me? And not knowing for sure. Well, I think we probably pretty well figured they were going to say yes, but you never. But see, that you've hit it right on the head. There's just like, that's the relationship we have with God. We are his wife. We are precious to him, so precious that he would die for us, and he did die for us. So again, it's just this beautiful image. And the fact that it is confirmed by righteousness, justice, steadfast love, and mercy. And of course, you know, Luther would say right away, now remember, the righteousness here isn't your righteousness. That's not what it's founded upon, the good things you've done, but it is founded upon the righteousness of God, by the fact that he is holy and again, just and steadfast love and in mercy. And what's so comforting about that, see, again, that it's not dependent on me. And maybe that's the whole point, huh? What we're going to get with this whole marriage with Gomer. She's an adulteress. This marriage can't depend upon her. She's broken the marriage, but the marriage depends upon the action of the husband here, the action of the Lord. And you're right, boy, that passage, I always use that for premarital counseling. And I said to the people, do you really know what you're getting into here? Are you ready to submit unto your husband in all things? But even more importantly, dear husband, are you ready to sacrifice everything, including football nights, for your wife? You know, yeah. But that's what Jesus does for us. He's willing to give it all up for us.
Oh, and we're so grateful that he has. Now, on the ground, by the way, I noticed just now as I was prepping to read our final five verses, is that's the whole chapter 3. I didn't notice that when I split it up. But anyway, yeah, chapter 3 is only 5 verses, and we're going to read them now. And Yahweh said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by another man and is an adulteress, even as Yahweh loves the children of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love cakes of raisins. So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver, says Hosea, and a homer and a lethek of barley. And I said to her, you must dwell as mine for many days. You shall not play the whore or belong to another man. So will I also be to you. For the children of Israel shall dwell many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or pillar, without ephod or household gods. Afterward, the children of Israel shall return and seek Yahweh their God and David their king, and they shall come in fear to Yahweh and to his goodness in the latter days. So, yeah, so God has called Hosea to go buy his wife back. I think that's just the fastest way to say it. But it's fascinating because, you know, he says he buys. Well, let's start with the first verse instead. So this whole idea of loving cakes of raisins and turning to other gods, that's religious practices is what I'm taking from it. False religious practices. And then we have here in verse 2, he buys her for shekels of silver and a homer and a lethek of barley. So does this suggest to you at all that she was involved perhaps even in the temple prostitution stuff, you know, because of all the religious connotations to it and the balls? What do you think?
I think that's a, you know, so I read a number of commentators on this and no one seemed to know what it was about.
That's fair. Okay. That's fair.
And in fact, a lot of them suggested maybe this isn't even Gomer. We think it's his wife. That's the natural conclusion we make, but it doesn't specifically say. He says love a woman that is loved by another man. So, but I would agree with what you said. It seems like the most logical thing. This is his wife. What's happened to her? I don't know. She's now has to be bought back. So apparently she's fallen into slavery. Apparently she has returned to her adulterous ways. I really like that thought, though. And by the way, of the many commentators I read, no one mentioned that. But it does kind of make sense that she's fallen back into the whole temple prostitution stuff. And I suppose, you know, you're not just going to take a temple prostitute. You're going to have to pay for, you know, that's how it is in our church. You don't just give your prostitutes away, do you, Pastor Boo? No, you make people. No, I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. No.
Yeah, we don't do that anymore. But yeah, I like that interpretation, that it is related again to all of this false religion. And yet he still says, go love her, even though she's an adulteress, even though someone else has loved her. The Baals have loved her. She's served the Baals. Pay whatever it takes to pay to get her back. You know, although isn't it interesting that now that she's back, you must dwell as mine for many days. You shall not play the whore or belong to another man. So will I also be with you. Because I know that is the criticism that is made of us, and probably a fair criticism, that people think, well, then I can just do as I damn well please, right?
Right.
What's the thing? Let's sin more so that grace can abound. And of course, no, absolutely not. That is not. That is to return back to that first chapter of God's judgment and wrath. How can you decline his grace and mercy that way and not expect that there's going to be problems?
Well, and the language here in general, though, of purchasing back, obviously that's pointing us forward to God's redeeming work. You know, we say redemption and he's redeemed me, and we talk about that kind of stuff, and I think it loses its original meaning, which means to exchange one thing for another. And so God in this case, Hosea literally exchanges things of value in order to get his wife back. God obviously exchanges that of greatest value, himself. Jesus dies for us so that he can redeem us. So it's not that God just says, okay, I'll just forgive everybody their sins and I'll just let it slide. Because of his justiceness and his righteousness, sin has to be atoned for, has to be. So he takes it on himself. And here we have Hosea taking it on himself to redeem his wife. And then that goes right into, of course, talking about the exile, the many days without the king, and then that wonderful future latter days. So yeah, afterward, the children of Israel shall return. Considering our conversation earlier, I wonder if children of Israel is used somewhat purposefully instead of, say, like the nation of Israel or just Israel in general. That's off the cuff, so it might be way off base, but I'm just wondering what you think. Because it isn't okay. The nation of Israel, it's the people.
I will answer that, but mm-hmm. You mentioned something in just your last statement that draws us back to those four things that were part of the betrayal, but the betrothal rather, that was the mm-hmm. righteousness, that was the justice, that was the mercy, and that was the steadfast love. And I just want to emphasize what you said. See, no, God can't simply say, "Oh, I forgive you." No, because he's a righteous God and he's a just God. And I think anyone who thinks about it understands that you don't see somebody do something evil and wicked and say, "Oh, well, that's okay. That's fine that you killed all those Jews, Hitler." No, that's not okay. That's wrong. Something has to be said because that's not the way things should be. See, so but you're right. So how does that be the justice and the righteousness? How can that be reconciled though with the love and with the mercy? Well, like you said, there needs to be a redemption. There needs to be a recognition that was horrible and wicked and evil. And so he's going to kill his own son. He's going to allow his own son to suffer, his own son to cry, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" Yeah, that's exactly what he's doing. But you better not take sin lightly then. No, God doesn't take it lightly. And trust me, you take it lightly. You'll find out, again, everything that we had at the beginning of Hosea. But it's all this fact that he does love them. And I agree with you too. Now back to your original question. I think that's a really keen insight. It's not the nation of Israel, because the nation of Israel is gone and done and will never be reestablished. But the fruit of that, the children of that, yeah, which includes you and me, right? Isn't that what the New Testament says? We are the new Israel. We are the children of Israel. Yeah, we do this. We've returned. We seek the Lord. We want the Son of David to be our king. And we do come in fear of the Lord. No, we know better than to just, we sin. I'm not denying that. But we know better. We know what happens when you openly, freely, willingly sin. We've seen the consequences of that. And then we have, like you say, the goodness, not here and now, but in the latter days. It's mm-hmm. still to come. Oh, there's plenty of goodness now. My goodness, Pastor Boo, we just have such a good time up here in Minnesota. Every night we go to bed and we thank God for all the blessings he's given us. But it's all tempered by the evil and wickedness and the realization that all the good stuff we have here is going to come to an end. Right. But not in the latter days. That'll be theirs. All those blessings will be us for us eternally.
Latter days, help define that real quick, because we only have a minute left. But in this case, latter days, you're seeing this as perhaps new heavens and new earth language. And I say that because some people think that we're in the latter days, meaning those days leading up to the end. I think in the context of this, I would lean more towards new heavens and new earth. But I'm curious what you think before we go.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you there, too. I mean... We are in the later days, in yeah. fact, that everything's accomplished. But I think this particular phrase, I'd have to look up and see what it actually is in the Hebrew there. But no, this is definitely talking about, as you pointed out earlier, that we still have war. We still have problems with animals and all that stuff. No, all this stuff obviously is something that lies ahead in the new heaven and the new earth, as you said.
Indeed. Well, folks, that's going to wrap it up for us today. I'd like to thank my guest this morning, the Reverend John Lukomsky, co-host of Wrestling with the Basics on KFUO Radio. You can find that on Saturday mornings, but also at kfuo.org/ Wrestling with the Basics. All right. Well, that's going to wrap us up. Thank you, brother, so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
I can't wait to have you on again. Yeah, thanks, brother. All right, folks, that's it. Until tomorrow, we're going to continue with Chapter 4 tomorrow. But until then, may God's peace and blessings be with all of you. As we all pray together, Father, keep us in thy strong word.